I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and our conversation today is about a plan to bring green jobs to primarily black inner cities. Could it help save both the polar bears and kids at risk in their own backyards? But first, today's big news. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has proposed what's being called the most sweeping changes to financial regulation since the Great Depression, changing the way the government oversees thousands of businesses. Paulson's plan would create a new federal mortgage commission, consolidate or eliminate existing regulatory institutions, and expand the Federal Reserve's role from overseeing just commercial banks to keeping an eye on all financial institutions.
The Fed would have the authority to go wherever in the system it thinks it needs to go for a deeper look to preserve stability. To do this effectively, the Fed will collect information from commercial banks, investment banks, insurance companies, and hedge funds.
The government says the plan has been in the making for a year, but it comes at a time when some economists say the U.S. is already in a recession, due in large part to the credit crunch brought on by the subprime mortgage crisis. Well, joining us now, Wall Street Journal reporter Damian Paletta, who discussed this plan with Treasury Secretary Paulson over the weekend and writes about it. Damian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to spend a few minutes on this. And at the outset, we want to say that there are definitely critics of the plan who don't see it as sweeping reform, and we'll get to that. But we're always surprised. I mean, people really have not paid much attention to this, it seems, until this crisis. And there are a lot of Americans who didn't know how little regulation there was of these mortgage lenders that have popped up in the last couple of decades. So explain to us what the situation is now that the government is proposing changing.
Sure. Really, bank regulation has been built brick by brick since the Civil War. There's been different parts added. You know, in the Great Depression, there were more agencies added. And when the savings and loan crisis, there was more agencies added. And each agency really was designed to look at a specific pocket of the financial services industry. And in the recent housing boom, we saw a bunch of these non-bank specialty finance companies, a lot of them based out in California, popped up. And they didn't have any federal oversight. They weren't banks necessarily. They didn't have any federal deposit insurance. So they were really able to operate without a lot of the rules and regulations that, you know, federally insured banks had. Of course, now we see some federally insured banks that, you know, were exposed to all this too. So, well, I think what Paulson's trying to suggest is, going forward, we need to look at, you know, just because something's a finance company and they act like a bank, you know, let's sort of get them all together and look at who should be regulating these specific issues, not necessarily, you know, what we call them.
Well, and we spoke to a mortgage lender last week who said, and she's part of a state program here in Massachusetts to train people,
right.
And she said she'd meet lenders who didn't know how to read a tax return, or there were reports of lenders who were encouraging people to lie on the application and say they had jobs. So let's tick through some of the plan, but before we do that, ask, what is it? Is it just a proposal, or is it something that's going to happen over time?
Oh, that's right. It's a proposal, and almost all of it would take legislation, which is, you know, very difficult. It's difficult to pass even a minor bill now, and this would be, you know, incredibly sweeping reform. So the chances of it happening anytime soon are very slim, and this is the kind of thing that could drag out over 8 or 10 years when there'll be, you know, obviously new people in the White House, new people in Congress, and that sort of thing.
Well, what are some of the things that are proposed?
Well, in the short term, one of the ideas is this thing called the Mortgage Origination Commission. And the problem that the Treasury officials saw was with state regulation, you know, each state regulates mortgage companies differently. So the idea is to have a sort of federal body that tries to rate the state oversight. And the idea was that states would be discouraged from getting a low rating because they think that no one would want to buy the loans for securities there. So that would sort of force people, that would incentivize states to oversee the markets better.
Now, we understand that in some states, some insurance companies are completely blocking out entire states, and in some cases blocking out zip codes. They don't want to insure loans in zip codes where there have been a lot of foreclosures. Would this kind of federal regulation maybe have more oversight of that?
I think so, and you know, in fairness to some of the proposals from congressional Democrats, I think a lot of these proposals that we're seeing, with, you know, with more involvement, is to bring some market stability, to give, you know, market Wall Street investors some more confidence that, you know, people are sort of watching what's going on, and that there aren't a lot of, you know, reckless products sort of filtering out into these securitizations and that sort of thing.
What about licensing? Figuring out who gets to be a lender?
That's a great question that everyone's really struggling with. I mean, one thing that we saw during the housing crisis, during the housing boom, was people that would get maybe, you know, busted for some sort of mortgage fraud in one state could go to another state and there'd be no record and they could just pick up and do it over again. So one thing that the Federal Reserve has, you know, endorsed, the Treasury Department, congressional Democrats as well, is creating some sort of, you know, national standard for licensing of lenders and brokers.
Well, you know, again, the government and others are calling this the most sweeping reform since the Great Depression. But you quote Barbara Roper of the Consumer Federation of America, which is an advocacy group, saying that this is actually loosening regulation. What is the criticism?
Well, I think a lot of consumer groups and a lot of Democrats feel like, you know, there's been a lesson learned from this whole credit crunch, and it is that the regulators need to be really on top of the lenders and not, you know, and really be testing them and second-guessing them and that sort of thing. And this proposal from the Treasury Department, some could argue, would not have, you know, regulators sort of on top of these companies like hawks. And this, you know, specifically with this idea of the Fed, I think, you know, having this sort of super umbrella type body, I think there could be concerns that, you know, things could slip through the cracks because there wouldn't be someone just watching over them really intensely. So,
in other words, it's a plan more for oversight than actual regulation.
Well, exactly. I think that's something that's going to have to be worked out, and there'll be a lot of, you know, talks and hearings and negotiation on this. And obviously, you know, Democrats have a lot of power because they run Congress right now. So, but that's exactly what one of the questions I think that people are going to have to struggle with.
Well, the point is that nothing's going to happen tomorrow or maybe even in the next year. This is an aspirational model that was announced today. And so we'll check in with you, Damian, to hear more about it as time goes on. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The Wall Street Journal's Damian Paletta. Presidential candidates are talking about jumpstarting the economy with what they're calling green-collar jobs. And the idea is catching on in Washington. Last December, President Bush signed into law an energy bill that authorizes $125 million to train up to 30,000 people for green jobs. Well, our next guest is credited with providing the energy to pass the Green Jobs Act. Attorney and social activist Van Jones is co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California. But after Jones made the connection between green jobs and reducing inner-city problems, he began pushing for green jobs in Oakland. Last June, Oakland became the first city in the country to create a Green Jobs Corps program. And this week, Van's officially launching the Green for All campaign. This is an effort to get Congress to back the energy bill jobs proposal, to actually write the check for that $125 million and start training young people for green-collar jobs. Van Jones, welcome.
Glad to be here.
We understand your crusade, if you will, started in 2006 during an ad campaign against a ballot initiative there in California. This ballot would have taxed oil companies drilling in California and used that money for alternative energies. What was the light bulb that went off for you during that ad campaign?
Well, I mean, I've been interested in this for longer than 2006, but certainly that was an important moment in that. We had a very good opportunity here in California to get a ballot measure passed that would have had a very small tax on our oil industry here and would have used that money to fund clean energy. It was a great idea. The problem was that it wasn't being sold to low-income people, working Californians, people of color, in any way that made sense. It was all talking about, oh, the clean, green future and energy independence and that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, the polluters began to use scare tactics to say that it was going to raise gas prices and home energy prices and scared the voters away from it. And I realized that we were in a situation where, you know, until this green movement began to speak much more forcefully and much more passionately to the kitchen table bread and butter issues of working Americans, we were always going to be in danger of there being a backlash alliance between, you know, polluters and poor people, essentially, afraid that anything we did to fix global warming would cost them too much out of their own pockets.
In fact, there was a concerted move on the part of the oil companies to buy ads in black-owned newspapers, one showing a black woman filling her gas tank with this look on her face at the gas pump, and that's when you know, further connected those dots that this was targeted at the black community.
Well, yeah, the polluters were more focused on moving the African-American and Latino vote than the mainstream environmental community was. And you know, my observation was that, you know, low-income people, people of color, we have the most to gain from a transition to a green economy. Why? Well, you know, the air will be cleaner when we're using solar panels and wind as opposed to dirty power plants where low-income people tend to live, you know, right there at the fence line. So our health will be better in a green economy. We've got to, you know, if we're going to beat global warming, we're going to have to weatherize millions of buildings. We're going to have to put up millions of solar panels, you know, create thousands of wind farms and wave farms, plant millions of trees. All those are jobs and contracts. So the economic opportunities, millions of jobs, tens of thousands of contracts, you know, trying to stay here stuck in this pollution-based economy where we don't have jobs, our health is bad, and now we've got, you know, floods in Arkansas, tornadoes wandering around downtown Atlanta, wildfires in California and Katrina, all those things disproportionately hurt, you know, poor people. Seems like a bad idea. Yeah. So I felt like we needed to really ramp up our conversation about the way that a green and clean economy is not just something that, you know, for the eco-elite in Hollywood to enjoy, but it would be something that would help all Americans.
How hard a sell is that to get either minority inner city or poor inner city people to respond to the environment as a problem?
Well, you know, trying to get, you know, people who already have a bunch of problems to respond to any new problem is very difficult. But the point is that it's only the eco-elite that have been, you know, insisting that we all see the environment as a problem. What we're saying is there is a set of ecological solutions that represent real economic opportunities for low-income people and for people of color.
Right.
We don't present the environment as a basket of problems. We present environmental solutions as a basket of opportunities for what we call green-collar jobs. You know, if you teach a young person in, you know, urban America how to put up solar panels, they're on their way to becoming an electrician. They can join a union. They can become, you know, part of the IBEW and be on a green pathway out of poverty. Right now, we don't have a green-collar job force to carry out any of our environmental visions.
Well, and I want to hear more about the solutions that you propose and where the programs are. But, you know, you're just reminding us, if you present it as a job-based issue as opposed to, oh, ice caps melting, you know, because I think I've heard you say, someone in the inner city is not going to be as concerned, perhaps, about ice caps melting or polar bears disappearing when they have potentially much worse, more immediate problems right on their block.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's very much true. I mean, everybody's crying about the polar bears dying, and you got, you know, nephews and cousins that are dying in your own neighborhood. You know, you're going to scratch your head and say, well, you know, why does everybody care about this and nobody cares about what's happening to me? But, you know, my view is that we can save that young person, you know, on the block, and we can save the polar bears by building a green economy, especially a green economy that is strong enough to lift millions of people out of poverty.
That's Oakland activist Van Jones. This week he's launching Green for All. That's a campaign to push Congress to come up with $125 million pledged in the energy bill to train people for green jobs. He'll be back in a moment. And later in the program, a casualty on the home front, the death of an Iraq War vet who just could not adjust to life back home. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Van Jones, co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California. This week, he's kicking off the Green for All campaign to get Congress to commit to writing a check for the $125 million promised in the energy bill to train up to 30,000 people for green jobs. Jones was instrumental in getting Congress to sign on to the idea of green jobs. He was at a small climate change roundtable in San Francisco last year, and in the small time he had, he said four magic words that intrigued House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Those words were Green Energy Jobs Bill. She picked up the idea and ran with it. Van Jones would later find himself testifying before Congress on this concept, and ultimately a green jobs program was tucked into the energy bill that was signed by the president last December. Van, what about green jobs where you are in Oakland? You started a program called the Green Job Corps. Last year it became the first program of its kind to be funded by a city. So where does it stand?
We are moving this summer to create a Green Jobs Corps. Last summer, in a big breakthrough politically here in Oakland, we got our city council to unanimously pass our proposal to create a Green Jobs Corps, which would begin to train Oakland's youth to stand in the front of the line for the new century's clean and green jobs, and back of the line for the last century's pollution-based jobs that are leaving the country anyway. We'll train about 40 young people in the first class, and then we'll start building it up from there. The exciting thing about it is that people across the country are now beginning to replicate this idea of a green jobs corps or green trades programs really all across the country. You know, our view about that is that, you know, we can't start soon enough. The new icon for the environmental movement will not be a polar bear, though we love polar bears. Won't be a hybrid car, though we love hybrid cars. It will be a working person with a green hard hat and a tool belt and a lunch bucket going off, sleeves rolled up, to fix America, tools in hand.
Well, as you said, in the kids that you're thinking of specifically, you're hoping that they go off with the hard hat and the toolbox, but then 10, 15 years down the road, they own the company that they've learned how to work in, whether it be solar energy or otherwise.
That's right. Many of them will become managers and owners and contractors themselves. And yet, we have to get back in this country to recognizing the dignity of skilled labor. Dignified, skilled work, people getting up in the morning, and you know, everybody wants to celebrate the PhDs. We also have to honor and celebrate our PhDs, the people who get up every morning and, you know, with the genius and the intelligence and the training of making this country work at a very practical level. So, yes, you know, when we talk about green jobs, we also are talking about green careers, but, you know, I think that every single person who's working to fix the environment and keep our economy going is a dignified contributor to this country.
Van Jones, I'm wondering about just one other element of this. You're talking about inner-city black kids in Oakland, but I'm also thinking of, you know, dirt-poor teenagers in Appalachia where, you know, the coal plants are not doing as well. You know, people in general who might be scratching their way up, and you're trying to tell them that this is not only, you know, good for them but good for the environment. What do you do about the response from some young people I can hear saying, wait a minute, I can finally pull it together. It's my turn, you know, to get an SUV. You're telling me that now that it's my turn, you know, to get the SUV, it's bad for the environment. You know, what do you do about that attitude from inner city kids or anyone?
Well, you know, in the kind of the most recent round of environmental conversation, it was all about, you know, you naughty consumer, you individual person, you need to recycle more, you need to buy this and not that. The new round of conversation that we're a part of definitely affirms all that and thinks people should take individual responsibility. But we're a lot more focused on the collective choices and the collective opportunities. In other words, you know, we think it's a lot more important at this stage to get people pushing on their senators and their congresspeople and their mayors to get government on the side of this so that, you know, cities are, you know, spending millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to retrofit their buildings and therefore creating jobs. We think that's, you know, as important, possibly more important than telling people what they should or shouldn't be buying at this stage. Hmm. I think that the economics of extravagant, you know, expense will begin to speak for itself. I don't think we have to go and beat people up and tell them not to buy an SUV. I think if you buy an SUV right now, you're going to have to live in it because gas prices are going up so high. Mm-hmm. I think that the next step is going beyond the individual consumer lecturing and talk about the collective community and government responses that begin to make all of these choices make more economic sense.
Van Jones is spearheading the Green for All campaign. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Van, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now we have a sad coda to a story we brought you last week. Dith Prawn, the photojournalist for The New York Times, whose tale of survival in his native Cambodia during the rule of the Khmer Rouge was told in the 1984 film The Killing Fields, died over the weekend. Dith had been suffering from pancreatic cancer. In the 70s, with war raging in Cambodia, Dith Prawn began working with Western journalists as a fixer and translator. Eventually, he met Sidney Shanberg of The New York Times and became a Times employee and trusted colleague. Last week, Here Now spoke with Shanberg as Dith was dying. He told us a story of how Dith Prawn saved his life when he and other Western journalists were captured by the Khmer Rouge at a hospital in the capital of Phnom Penh.
And when we started to leave, an armored personnel carrier, which had been captured by the Khmer Rouge, rolled into the hospital grounds. Men jumped out and put guns to our heads and told us to get into this tank-like vehicle. And Prawn just kept chattering at them, and they kept chattering back at him. Finally, they herded us into this vehicle, and Prawn got in. And I asked him what was going on outside. He said, they told me to go away. They didn't want me. They wanted the tom-toms, the big people. And then inside this tank, he kept chattering at the crew that we were not there to harm them or do damage to their reputations, but simply to record their victory.
And Dithpran kept on talking, Schanberg said, until they were eventually let go. Soon, though, Schanberg was forced to leave Cambodia, and Dith spent 4 years in forced labor camps hiding his identity. The two were later reunited in a refugee camp. Dithpran was 65 years old. Schanberg visited him one last time on Saturday. The two friends promised to send each other their dreams. Dithpran died Sunday. We'll be back with a story of a current war after the news here and now. Soldiers go missing in Iraq. The remains of one, Army Sergeant Matthew Maupin, were just found and identified. He'd been missing for nearly 4 years after his unit was ambushed near Baghdad. But some troops also go missing when they come home. Eric Hall is in the ranks of those domestic casualties, a young 24-year-old Marine who was never able to adjust to life after the war. He died on the home front, but his death gave other veterans a sense of purpose. Reporter Damien Cave tells Eric Hall's story in today's New York Times. He joins us now on a cell phone. Damien, who was Eric Hall?
Eric Hall was a typical Marine like a lot of other Marines. He had signed up straight out of high school in Indiana, had been deployed once to Afghanistan and once to Iraq, where he was wounded. And he came home and just really struggled to get going again. And sadly, that meant a flashback at his aunt's house in Florida that sent him into the woods.
Well, and what might that flashback have been of? What happened to him in Iraq?
He was wounded by a roadside bomb that destroyed much of his left leg up by his thigh and killed a friend of his. He was actually conscious throughout this experience, so he has vivid memories of being in the Humvee as it bounced along this road and being in this terrible, awful pain, and then being shipped to a base there, to Germany, and then home, but still knowing and living this, reliving that experience in a lot of ways.
What were the signs of his distress when he came home to Indiana?
Some were physical, some were mental. He was dealing with, at least his parents said that he had at least 20 surgeries on his leg. He was dealing with pain medication, and he kept dealing with not fitting in once he came home. He said to his mother, you know, everyone's moving on, but I'm not.
Yeah.
He had lost his career in the Marine Corps that he loved, and he was struggling to find another way to do something.
Interesting note. His mother told you that his friends in Indiana seemed to be people who were more interested in his pain medication than in him.
Yeah, it was hard to tell exactly what they meant by that, but I think that he just felt disconnected from the life at home, and losing his sense of mission after not being a Marine anymore was very hard for him to overcome.
Right, just this image, which he hadn't thought of before, of these returning Iraq vets maybe being preyed upon by people who would want things like their pain medication. So Eric Hall moves to Florida, maybe a new start, moves in with a relative, and you say he had a flashback. How do people know he had a flashback?
He was with his grandmother, and he, at some point, you know, he was watching TV, and then he suddenly said to his grandmother, you know, who was just out on the patio, you need to come inside. They're all around us. And he was carrying in his arms an imaginary gun, and he was hiding below the windows. And then he said to her, I've got to go, I've got to go. And he ran out of the house and jumped on his motorcycle and disappeared. And his cousin and some of his friends in the area said that they had seen other moments when he would wake up in the middle of the night and seem to not be present. So there were a few warning signs, but no one ever thought that this is how it would end up.
Well, and here's where Eric Hall's tragic story dovetails with the stories of so many others who turned out to search for him. His mom put out the word. There were news reports. Who came forward?
It was a really interesting mix of people, some of them young Iraq veterans like this guy who had been a recruiter in the area, but many of them were Vietnam veterans who, to a certain extent, had felt disconnected from this war as they still struggled with the war that they had survived. But something in Eric Hall's story connected with them, and he became a brother to them. So, you know, they got out and they searched. Some slept out at night. I mean, the level of effort and work that these guys put in, all of whom were strangers before Eric disappeared, was really quite astounding. There was a sense for them and for many others of responsibility, that somehow they had to help Eric because other elements of society were not.
Yes, you say that the Vietnam vets couldn't identify with the current military because these were troops who were, at least in the beginning, coming home to parades, and they were on the sidelines, as are most Americans, until this search for Eric Hall. But you also write how Eric Hall impacted one Army recruiter in particular who'd since retired but had been a recruiter in the past decade. Tell us Billy Huther's story.
He was a guy who had moved to Florida a few years ago as a recruiter, and he had an experience where a young man in Iraq who he had recruited was killed in 2004, and it was this really devastating experience that made him feel responsible. So his first thought when he heard that there was an Iraq veteran missing was, oh, my God, not again. I hope this isn't someone I recruited. And for him, that was the first challenge. And then the second challenge was that he still had memories from his own experience in Iraq, and he was struggling to get back into these fields in Florida that in certain cases look like Iraq.
You're right. He couldn't do the search of the sandy dunes. He could only do the searches of the waterways because the dune area just reminded him too much of Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, he really felt that the area just would bring him back, that it would possibly send him into a flashback. And in some ways, this speaks to how fragile some of these returning soldiers feel, where on the surface they may feel like everything's fine, but then in certain moments, something makes them snap back to the experience that they've tried to leave behind.
Well, it's also interesting, too, because it's something, frankly, many people hadn't thought of, that recruiters now in retirement are sitting there praying that someone that they brought into the service and went to Iraq isn't killed.
It's a really difficult actuality for these guys. I've met a few of these people who have been recruiters who know the families of these kids. You know, they had recruited them and convinced them to join up, and then to see them die is something that's really devastating. I mean, I think the reverberations of this war come out at home in a lot of different ways, and that's just one example.
Mm. Well, in the end, it's one of the Vietnam-era vets who crawls into a drain pipe on the side of the road where Eric Hall's motorbike was found.
He crawled in this pipe, which was 3 feet in diameter, just with a knife and a flashlight, and dug his way through dirt, bugs, water, and this horrible scent that he only hoped was a raccoon. But when he got there, he could tell that it was a person. And he told me later that he couldn't get that image out of his mind, and that he was having dreams about not just his Vietnam experience, but now this experience of finding Eric Hall. So for him, in some ways, his war and Eric Hall's war really did combine in his mind.
But what a gift to his parents to finally know where he is. But do we know what happened?
Well, what it looks like happened is, and this is what Charlie Shaughnessy and the authorities have come to believe, is that Eric fled the house after the flashback and ended up in this field that did look in some ways like the river valleys of Iraq. He maybe smoked a cigarette, and there was a small brush fire that they know started that day. And what they think happened is that he climbed into the pipe seeking cover. A person who hadn't been a Marine maybe would run to the road, but he instead ran for cover into the pipe and pushed himself in and pulled a couple rocks in behind him in an effort to hope that the fire would die down. And it looks like he suffocated in there, or there was smoke inhalation. So that's what it looks like happened.
Damien, it's an incredibly uplifting story in some ways, in, you know, the ways that so many people were transformed as they reached out to search for Eric Hall. But is Eric Hall counted as a casualty of war?
I don't believe he's counted by the military as a casualty of war, but I can tell you that the parents count him as a casualty of war, and that's something that they spoke about explicitly with me. I mean, they really hope to be able to go to Congress, or they were talking about starting a foundation. They want people to understand that this experience is not uncommon and that in many ways it's directly connected to the war. So, you know, I hope that they get that opportunity. But for them, this was clearly a sign of a war coming home.
To Florida. New York Times reporter Damien Cave on the story of Eric Hall. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Damien, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in the days ahead, we're going to take a look at the situation in Iraq. The Iraqi government may have started the crackdown on Shiite militias, but it was a militia leader who stopped that crackdown. Is Muqtada al-Sadr calling the shots in Iraq? That's in the days ahead. And don't forget, before we go today, the band Ethel. You're listening to Here and Now. So, you say you still haven't given up those bad habits you promised to quit at New Year's? Well, a couple of Yale professors say they have a solution, and producer Karen Fritchie decided to test their theory. Now, a warning, this story may not be suitable if you have little kids listening, are a fan of the National Rifle Association, or are trying to quit smoking.
I have a confession to make. I am a closet smoker. Most of my friends don't know it. I've gotten very good at hiding it. But I'm a sucker for a good cigarette. I smoked as a teenager and all through college, then quit for 10 years. But after a bad breakup, I was in a bar and, well, I've been playing with fire ever since. Rough day at work? Bum a smoke. Cat dies? Buy a pack. I tried quitting cold turkey, tried the 12-step Nicotine Anonymous program, tried hypnosis. Kept on smoking. Then I talked to Yale professor Dean Carlin. He's a behavioral economist. He looks at why we do what we do and figures out whether money can change it.
We all have our weaknesses. Like, I am incredibly disciplined when it comes to work, but when it comes to food, I'm horrible. I love wine and cheese and chocolate, and I need to put constraints in my life so that I behave the way I want to behave.
So Carlin and his Yale law professor buddy Ian Ayers started making bets with each other. Drop 20 pounds or lose $500. They both lost. Weight, not money. Now they've launched stick.com. That's stick with a C and two K's. So others can create commitment contracts. Break the habit or lose the cash. Worth a try. I took out a quit smoking contract on myself.
First name, Karen Fritchie. Screen name.
To guarantee I'd stay tobacco-free for 2 weeks, I put up $500, enough to buy 100 packs of cigarettes. I upped the ante by choosing the National Rifle Association as the group that would get my money if I failed. I'm not a big NRA fan. And I designated my friend Kristen Frederick as my referee because she'd love to turn me in if I cheated.
I am wearing black and white, incidentally, so I feel ready for this job. And I think $500 to the NRA would be so funny and terrible. I think this actually might work.
Since its January launch, 3,000 people have signed commitment contracts on stick.com. They're risking more than $100,000. Dean Carlin says the most common commitments are to lose weight, exercise more, or quit smoking. But there are customized goals, too.
A lot of times people put on something about healthy eating, like I commit to drinking fewer sodas, I commit to drinking more water, I commit to eating broccoli 3 days a week. There's several about porn. My favorite one on that spectrum was someone who committed to more, watch less porn.
Well, one thing at a time. Day one was brutal. My eyes burned, my head throbbed. That night, I found a stray cigarette my ref had neglected to destroy. It had camouflaged itself on my kitchen counter, white on white. God, or maybe Philip Morris, was testing me. I so failed. For the next day and a half, I battled the temptation to lie to my friends and to the website holding my $500 ransom. Ultimately, the truth and the National Rifle Association won out.
What are you thinking, throwing away money like that? Because I left it on the counter? I'm a terrible referee, huh?
The worst referee ever refused to help pay my NRA penance. At least it was only $250. I still had a shot at keeping the rest. I became hell-bent to not let it happen again.
Put in your head the mental image of us sending that money off to the NRA, and when you pick up that cigarette, think of a gun and say to yourself, is that what you want to support? And if you get that image linked, then hopefully you won't light up.
12 days later, Kristen came over to witness my success. I took a disposable nicotine test to prove it.
And it's negative. Congratulations, you're not pregnant.
And for a week and a half, I'm not a smoker either. It's a start. And I have to admit, the money thing helped. Now I'm thinking about other commitments I can make to improve my life, like a lasting relationship. Maybe the guy who's trying to watch less porn wants to hang out. As long as he doesn't like to smoke after, well, you know.
Karen Fritchie in Los Angeles. For more on Stick, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay right there. In 1 minute, Ethel. It's more than one person will explain. Here and now. Brain. brace yourself. This is not your mother's string quartet. Its members do play viola, violin, and cello, and were trained at Juilliard, but they call themselves a band, and they call their band Ethel. They don't debate whether or not to mic their sound. They only use amplification. They mix classical music with rock, often adding choreography and the occasional African parrot, as heard on this selection from their CD, Light. Ethel is in the middle of what they call their truck stop project, teaching in communities around the country through performance and residencies. But in between stops, they call New York City their home. We caught up with two of the band members, Mary Rowell and Ed Farris, at the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York, and began with the origin of the group's name.
The name Ethel comes from the movie Shakespeare in Love. Shakespeare was having writer's block, and he was supposed to write this farcical comedy called Romeo and Ethel the Pirate's Daughter.
That's correct.
I said, what about Ethel? We played with that for a while, and we just started laughing and having a great time, you know, like Ethel goes to Paris, Ethel plays Carnegie Hall.
Ethel does a radio interview from Carnegie Hall.
That's right. Well, Ralph Farris, what about the music? Was there a musical mission statement? You know, here is what we want to sound like.
Well, actually, the music really did inform our mission. It was the music that found us. I think one of the first pieces that really got us all was the second piece that we played, which was by John King, John's Sweet Hardwood. It's informed by the music of the Mississippi Delta, and John's a guitarist himself and a fiddle player, and he knows how to write for strings. And what he put down on paper and what he gave to us was so very inspiring to us that energy, that feel, made us say, wow, we've got to do more of this.
In fact, you also compose your own music. Mary, you composed the piece we heard a little of in our introduction. It is a variation on another piece on the CD, Sambula. If I got that right, Sambula?
Sambula. Sambula.
Sambula.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for saying it correctly.
Let's listen to a little of Sambula. Let's listen to also Sprach Einstein. Einstein, by the way, the name of that African gray parrot I mentioned. What's going on there?
It was inspired by a Hawaiian recording I heard of a drumming group playing, it was listed on the record as samba. I said, that's a great Ethel piece. So I took that rhythm, and I'd been interested in trying to incorporate Hawaiian music into our repertoire for some crazy reason, and so I took a Hawaiian theme and put that over the top of it, and when I made the version of it for Ethel, it's great, but it just needed something, and we met this bird. He was one of our fellow speakers at a TED conference in Monterey, California.
And what's the TED conference?
Technology, Entertainment, Design.
Yeah, the bird Einstein was one of the speakers, along with Ethel. It's an African gray parrot, and it speaks about 65 words. Anyway, I definitely wanted to try to incorporate it into the Sambula song. And by the time it was done, it seemed like it was a completely different piece than the original piece. And so it became like, well, which one's going to go on the CD?
Why not both?
It ended up being sort of a postlude at the end there, a little.
Hey, if you have an opportunity to collaborate with the bird, you really need to go for it.
Well, and you also have, it's not all African parrots. Let's listen to a little more from Light. This is Sickness and Death. The New York Times compared it to the work of composer Arvo Pärt. Let's listen to a little of that.
Thank you.
Ralph, obviously a mood change there.
It's a very profound, very deeply felt piece, and what we're actually creating, I believe, is a sense of space. So we are never in a hurry with this particular movement, and it is all about feeling the room around us and do the audience with us. In our performance practice, there is typically no fourth wall, so we are feeling the room breathing with us as we are playing these notes.
You say no fourth wall. You know, for, you know, in television, there's the screen between the TV and you. What do you mean, no fourth wall?
The audience is recognized as part of any presentation that we make. Generally, there are a few different types of shows we put on in which that wall is back up, but generally, we are welcoming the audience, we're speaking with them, we are sometimes even interacting with them during a show. It's a sense of community and warmth around our performance that is important to us and defines part of our performance style.
Would you ever think of, you know, I have an idea on our next program. Let's do a straight Beethoven string quartet. That would be
yes.
The most... You say yes.
We've thought about it and we've talked about it. We've been encouraged to do it, but we feel a little bit like that's what other string quartets do.
But wouldn't it be so shocking to the audience if you did that? People would be thinking, what do they mean by that?
That is, for us also, creating a program where that would work for us and be an Ethel program. And it certainly has potential. I think we're actually getting closer to actually picking up the music at some point.
I just want to, before we let you go, talk about your truck stop tour, doing residencies, you know, actually living in communities for several days around the country, teaching classes but also listening to the music. Just some of the artists, because I know you're going to be gathering them in sort of a reunion at the end of the whole tour. Who are some of the artists you'll be meeting along the way?
Folks like Dean Osborne, he's basically bluegrass royalty. Ava Ibarra, who is an accordion player.
We were in Chicago and worked with a wonderful drumline group called Chaotic Drumline.
They are just
awesome. Jamie Poindexter started that as a way to get kids interested in doing things besides hanging out on the streets and getting shot. And I was so happy to feel like we had presented the first chamber music concert of the series at Dominican University and probably in the world of a string quartet and drumline.
Another first for Ethel.
It's been done.
We've been talking to Mary Rowell and Ralph Ferris, two Ethel band members. And by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org, to see more about the Truck Stop Tour. I want to thank both of you for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you so much.
So cool. We're going to leave you with Ethel and Chaotic Drumline performing Buckets. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. To our new listeners from WBHM-FM in Birmingham, Alabama, we extend the warmest of welcomes. So glad you could join us today because we've never before had a singing parrot and a drumline with a string quartet. Join us again. Here and Now. Hey.